This week's episode of the Slash Filmcast is sponsored by Bonnaroo.co.uk, the State Department of Fashion Corrections. Purveyors of top quality movie tribute and pop culture t-shirts and hoodies in sizes up to 5XL. American customers can enter the promo code FILMCAST, all one word, for free shipping on their orders. Again, that's Bonnaroo, Bonnaroo.co.uk. And welcome to the Slash Filmcast, the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. My name is David Chen, and with me are
Devendra Hardwar
and Adam Quigley.
Just so you guys know, for first-time listeners, you can find all of our episodes at SlashFilmcast.com, and you can email us at SlashFilmcast@gmail.com. Typically, we begin each week by talking about what we've been watching, move on into a dissection of the week's film news, and then conclude with one in-depth review. However, this week we're going to be reversing the order of the normal episode because we have a special guest with us tonight. Joining us tonight is the writer, actor, and director behind films such as Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Dogma, and Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. His most recent film, Zack and Miri Make a Porno, is now
Holy
out.
Shit, dude, cut the chase, man. Let's just go. Like, they, you know, they all know. They're like, well, nobody else ever calls into the show, so it's got to be the fat dude.
Who is this Kevin Smith?
Yeah, exactly. They're like, didn't he talk about Dark Knight? No, it's no surprise. Hello, everybody. I'm here.
I was trying
to that
to
intro going like, they all know, dude, and half of them don't like those movies, so let's move on. Let's not remind them how much they don't like me before I start talking. Yeah, then I got to spend the whole podcast winning them back. You're killing me, Dave.
I'm sorry.
You're killing me. This is why I work alone.
Sorry, sir. I was just trying to give your new movie some business. That's all. But
thank you. Yeah. Well, listen. Well, where were you when I needed you, Dave? That's what I'm asking. Don't give me business when it's on video. God damn it. I need box office. Anyway, right. How is everyone doing this evening? How are you? How are you? And how are you?
We're doing well, sir. How are you doing tonight?
I'm very, very well. Should we not bury the lead and just address which one of us did not like Watchmen right away?
No, all of us liked Watchmen, I think. So there's nothing.
Then why the fuck are we going to talk about it if we all like it?
All right. Well, how about this, Kevin Smith? Why don't you tell us why you liked Watchmen so much?
Oh, I thought it was the most. I think. You will never get a more faithful adaptation of The Watchmen. I think if there's ever going to be a Watchmen movie, that is the best version of it that could have existed. I don't think there's a better Watchmen movie out there. That being said, I love it. Like, I just thought he did a really fantastic job. I thought it was like watching the book come to life. And, you know, maybe people can write that off as like it's fanboy porn, but you know what? Then it was well-executed fanboy porn. It was like a copy of Playboy as opposed to Hustler or Jugs. It was just phenomenal watching it be every step of the way. I talked to my friend Walter. You know, I'd seen it months and months ago. He hadn't seen it until just the other day. And he was just like, it was just crazy, dude. Like, every time the scene changed, it was like, I can't believe they kept that. I can't believe they kept that. I can't believe they kept that. He's like, and then you just get tired of saying it. You realize this may be the truest adaptation of a comic book ever made. Or maybe of any book ever made. It is so faithful to the source material, with the giant exception of like the deviation, you know, at the end.
Right.
But, you know, do you think that's a harmful thing towards getting mainstream viewers to be interested in the movie? Because that's the impression I'm getting.
Which one? What do you mean?
The ending or the whole movie?
No, I mean just being so faithful to the book and everything. It's definitely
I've read a review or two. The review in the New York Times I thought was kind of interesting because the review seemed to be more about Moore's book than the movie itself.
Right.
And basically the you know, I don't want to put words in the mouth of the critic, but like essentially his take was like, you know, hey man, this shit is for children. You know, like, why are people like, it's ridiculous that I was made to sit this movie. Like, you know, he was saying, look, the source material is dopey stuff. So why is anybody surprised that the movie's dopey or something? I was kind of like, I found that the review was more about the source material than the movie itself.
Yep.
And I thought that was kind of weird. And basically, he did point out that perhaps the movie was too faithful to the source material. And yeah. that, in his estimation, hurt it. But that's what makes the movie good. I mean, it was a you've got to admire Zack Snyder for taking it on, right? Because he was fucked either way. Didn't matter what he did. If he makes the best Watcher movie, which he did, people are still like, oh, it's too faithful to the source material. And if he deviated in any way and kind of like, hey, man, I'm going to filter it through my vision and make a Watchmen movie that's, you know, maybe he does the Shining version of it, like the Kubrick Shining as opposed to the Stephen King book. And then he would have been fucked that way, too, because everyone would have been like, he should have stayed close to the book. So you got to give him credit for, like, insanely going into a no-win scenario. It was Kobayashi Maru. He is Kirk.
Nice.
You know, to keep it within the realm of the discussion group I'm in the midst of, I think you guys will back me up on he is absolutely Kirk.
Yeah, so. No, completely agree.
I mean, it's shocking to me that I woke up on Monday morning and there were some people going like, I don't know, is $55 million? Is somebody jerking off? Joining, that was really loud. Did you hear that?
Joining us tonight, joining us right now is the editor-in-chief of SlashFilm.com, who apparently has run to get here. Peter Serena.
Peter, you are just breathing. Is the microphone in your throat?
I thought it was Jason Voorhees.
You don't understand the lengths I went to get back here. Obviously, I'm not in time. But
all I would suggest is when you're not speaking, press that mute button. You are out of breath, dude. Like, you literally sound like Darth Vader. You're like...
All right.
But we're glad you're here. We're glad you're here.
Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
I don't know what I was just saying. I forget. Peter rudely interrupted me with his...
You know, I'll let you guys talk for a little bit.
You're talking about Kobayashi Maru and how he's screwed either way.
Would you agree that he is Captain Kirk in this situation?
Well, I was saying that, you know, the book... I completely agree with you, Kevin. I think the book doesn't facilitate it's like being made into a movie. And so to make it into a movie is to fundamentally change it in certain ways. And I think Zack Snyder really struck a good balance between making the film still consumable for general audiences unfamiliar with the graphic novel and also making it faithful enough that, you know, people like us can still geek out about all the cool scenes that were included from the book.
Right.
Can I ask actually, Kevin, like, were there any scenes in particular that you really enjoyed being brought to life?
Oh Lord, I mean that's like just throw a rock and you'll hit one. But I would say the jailbreak sequence was pretty amazing. Just in as much as like, wow, man, he did it. He actually said big figure, small world. He cut the dude's arms off. Which I don't know, was that very clear in the comic? Did he ever cut the dude's arms off?
No, he did not do that. In the comic.
He didn't do that. He just tied him there, and then they cut the dude's throat, right?
Yeah.
Their version makes more sense. Like, the movie version makes more sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because if there's a dude impeding your way, and you tie, and his arms are tied around a jail cell that, you know, he's blocking it from opening, cutting his throat just means he's going to be even in your way even more, right?
I guess, but to be fair...
Like, cutting his arms off is like, all right, this is getting the dude out of here. But I remember seeing that and going, like, did they cut his arms off in the movie?
Well,
I do remember they did the toilet with the electrocution thing, and that rocked as well. That whole sequence I thought was fit. Everything with Rorschach was fantastic.
Yeah.
I thought John's whole Mars interlude was so pitch perfect and like watching the book brought to life. Some people don't go for the Republic serial villain ending. I've always loved that. I mean, I used it in Dogma, for heaven's sakes. So that ending really did it for me. There was one thing that when I first saw it, I talked to Zach and I was like, did you guys shoot during the scene where Rorschach and Ozymandias are in Adrian's office trying to find some clues as to what happened? And Rorschach is looking around and he starts talking about, like, perhaps this is... He's trying to figure out who's behind it, and he's like, perhaps it's Moloch engineering the plan from beyond the grave. And this is not literal at this point. I'm paraphrasing it. I'm not, you know, and I realize I'm wrecking Alan Moore's dialogue, but bear with me. But he had this one line, which I always thought was so fucking awesome. And I couldn't wait to hear it, but they didn't shoot it. So unfortunately I didn't get to hear it. And it was, you hear Rorschach say, Egyptian decor coloring logic. because he was like, he came up with the idea that perhaps it was Moloch who was going after them from beyond the grave. And then he was like, no, I'm being retarded. And the reason I'm being retarded is because I'm looking at all these Egyptian fucking statues. But I just, I mean, that line, I always love that line in the book, Egyptian decor coloring logic. And I kind of rock it in my personal life whenever I can. Nice. So to people who understand, like, I can't say it to my wife. She'd be like, what the fuck? I could say it to, like, Brian Johnson, Walter Flanagan, Scott Mosier. I could say Egyptian decor, color, and logic. But long and short of it, it wasn't in the movie, so fuck this picture. No. I totally asked him. I was like, dude, please tell me you shot it. He goes, we didn't. That wasn't in the script. I was like, all right. That was just a little thing. That did not diminish the movie in the least for me. I thought he did a phenomenal job.
Yeah. I mean, it's a book full of so many great little things that you're bound to miss something. Like, I feel like in the Dr. Manhattan origin sequence, there's a shot of him, like, as he's rebuilding himself. One of the sequences is just like, you know, the eyes and a brain and a spinal cord appears or something. And that imagery in the book really worked for me. But, you know, I would have liked to see in the movie. Oh, well, it's not there.
Yeah, I think a lot of people kind of I've talked to a lot of people about this movie, and everyone has sort of something they wish that was in the movie that wasn't in the movie. But I guess that's kind of a testament to how rich Alan Moore's original graphic novel is. Yeah. I want to talk about some of the changes that Zack Snyder made. But before I do that, I just want to ask real quickly, Adam Quigley, your general thoughts on Watchmen.
Well, right off the bat, I do want to say I love the movie. It offered everything I was hoping for from a Watchmen movie. And it also didn't deliver on everything I knew it couldn't. And that's actually, I think, part of the reason why so many people disliked it is that they were expecting things from it that it would never be able to deliver. Because when you get down to it, the Watchmen graphic novel just doesn't translate well to film. Yep. It's not structured like a movie at all. Mm-hmm. The first half of it is almost entirely flashbacks. That alone, it just doesn't work for film. So when people review the movie and talk about how the pacing is all over the place, I'm thinking, of course it is. That's what you get when you take the graphic novel and translate it basically scene for scene to an almost 3-hour film.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then obviously with that, you start getting into like the limitations of making a completely faithful adaptation of the source material. We can get more into that later. But basically, as a fan of the graphic novel, who was also completely aware of the problems that would come with making a film adaptation and was also willing to forgive those problems, I absolutely loved the movie. For me, it was just an awesome experience to see the graphic novel presented in this whole new way. And Adam, I kind of think those are
Adam, I think that Warner Brothers should put that long ass quote on a poster. that absolutely unqualified rave of like 5 minutes of disclaimers at the end of it. That being said, I liked it.
It'll be like that taken poster.
I do think that's like the huge issue, and that's kind of people's problem with it, is that they didn't realize when they were seeing these awesome trailers for the movie, they weren't aware that it's like, okay, but the graphic novel doesn't work. So now that you're bitching about how the pacing is all over the place, you obviously were expecting things that the movie wouldn't be able to deliver. And as a fan of the graphic novel, you should just know that going in and just enjoy it for what it is, because it's fucking awesome.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's not even a case of, like, as I referenced before, The Shining, where you're like, hey, I like Stephen King's book, but I also like Stanley Kubrick's movie. And they can coexist together. Even though they're close, they're not nearly the same thing. This is a case of, like, his movie is practically the same thing as the book. Mm-hmm. As close as you can get in cinematic form.
Yeah, definitely.
But it will still, like, for some people, as Adam's saying, there are people it's just never going to connect with because they're like, look, this can't be a movie. It never could have been a movie. And forcing cinematic conventions on it is not going to make it work for them, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, like, there's also, I guess, a debate as to, like, could you actually alter things in Watchmen and make it a good movie? Because with other books or comics, when you adapt them, there are ways you can change it around and still make it work. Like, if you look at another one of Alan Moore's comics, V for Vendetta, I mean, the fans of that graphic novel hate the movie, but generally people love that movie, as I do. Yeah. I think it's an excellent film, and they change it so much from the source material.
And that is an example. But I love that source material, but I also really enjoyed that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, and with Watchmen, though, I think there are things that you just can't change. I mean, what makes Watchmen what it is the way its story is told.
Right.
So changing that, I think, would just lose so much of it. So I think they definitely took – Zack Snyder, I think, went the proper route when making this movie. I just keep thinking back on how much this film could have been fucked up if they hadn't gone that route. Like, they were going to set it in the present and have it in Iraq and fighting the war on terror. It's like, oh, they could have ruined it so poorly.
Right.
And I'm just glad that Zack Snyder did it.
Yep.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like he did – I don't want to overpaint it or kind of oversell it, but I think of Zack Snyder as a messianic Jesus-like figure in this.
No, and he's not making movies. He's walking on water.
He really is. He's a miracle maker who had to make a big sacrifice for all of us. He had to be the one to go make the Watchmen movie. Somebody had to do it. It was going to happen, and it was Zack Snyder, thank God, because he made something that kind of looks like the Watchmen. I think it looks exactly like the fucking Watchmen. I'm not even mincing words. That movie looks like the Watchmen, man. And in others' hands, it might not have. You might have gotten something that was closer to the fucking Fantastic Four version of the Watchmen. You know what I'm saying? Or you might have got the Dolph Lundgren Punisher version of the Watchmen, where, you know, people have their symbols on fucking tips of knives and that's it. Otherwise, it's just people in normal clothes. So this dude actually kind of went out there and took the fucking hit. Somebody was going to do it, and he stepped up and he was like, you know what? I'll do it. Why not me? Yeah. And, you know, he had amazing goodwill built up from 300, and he went on what many would consider a fool's errand. But he did it because he was just like, this will mean that at least this version exists and nobody's going to make, like, a really terrible version of this movie that nobody is defensible. So I give him props for that, man.
You look at interviews with Zack Snyder, like, towards the end of filming and everything, and that man looks like death. Like, he looks like he's near death because of this.
Yes, just like Jesus looked like he was near death. Right before, you know, when they found him in Gethsemane and whatnot, before they turned him over to Pontius Pilate. That's where Zack Snyder was Thursday before release, and Friday begins the passion of Zack Snyder. He'll weather the storm. I mean, here's the thing. He made a fantastic movie. So I think, you know, it doesn't matter what it does at the box office, it doesn't matter, because he made a great flick. That dude will work forever. He's way talented, and he did a ballsy thing. What I think this movie, and I could speak personally on the subject, what making The Watchmen does is makes Warner Brothers look like the ballsiest studio on the planet right now. Mm-hmm. Like, that attracted me to Warner Brothers so much so that now I'm going to Warner Brothers to work, because I'm like, wow, man, if they're willing to make The Watchmen, and I don't mean like if they're willing to make a superhero movie, come on, dude. There's a world of difference between making a Batman movie and making the fucking Watchmen. I mean, maybe not lately, because The Dark Knight was pretty dark. But generally speaking, if you're going to make a comic book movie, like The Watchmen's the last one that any studio would want to undertake, because you don't have any built-in property whatsoever in terms of like, well, at least there was a Saturday morning cartoon at one point. Maybe people remember the characters from there. Nothing. Like, you have to know that source material and be part of that world. So the fact that those dudes were like, you know what? Fuck it. Let's do it. I was just like, right on, man. I would like to work there because those dudes have balls. Nobody else is making that movie. Nobody else.
Warner Brothers also made Speed Racer, which, love it or hate it, is like,
it's ballsy,
totally,
man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're in a good place right now. That's why I went over there. I was attracted to, like, wow, man, they're making moves over there. They're not just making safe movies. They definitely make safe movies. They have to. They're a studio. But they're also taking some chances, man. You take something like putting Christopher Nolan onto Batman. I mean, come on, that's a big chance. And now it makes sense. But when they did it, it's a big chance. Now they're putting Guy Ritchie on Sherlock Holmes. I don't know. It's like, that's what drew me to it, is something like them making The Watchmen. So maybe there are other filmmakers that feel the same way, who are like, you know what, man? Like, hats off. They stood up and backed a movie that nobody else would make. Let's go work there.
Yeah, yeah. I want to go back.
Does that sound like a guy who's sucking the dick of the corporation he's about to go for?
Not at all.
Well done,
is it that
sir.
Naked and transparent? But honestly, that's the way I feel. But I just should put it out there, because I know a bunch of people are like rolling their eyes right now. I would be if I was in the audience.
Well, I want to go back to a remark you said about Zack Snyder being Christ-like in this task. I think, you know, it's
very tongue-in-cheek. Let's point out a very tongue-in-cheek.
Very tongue-in-cheek.
I don't need the Catholic League coming back at me like, oh, you think the guy who made Watchmen Jesus now? We knew you were in trouble. You're so confused. You're like a fat Martin Luther in shorts. Yeah, because you can't wear pants because your legs are fat. Anyway, go ahead.
If you think about some of the previous versions, I mean, I don't know that I would want anything that's been mentioned. One of the options was a Joel Silver produced version of Watchmen with Arnold Schwarzenegger as Dr. Manhattan, would have been pretty different. And even Paul Greengrass, who I'm a huge fan of. He was slated to direct Watchmen at one point either, and I don't. Well, I think that would have been.
What about Darren Aronofsky?
Well, that one I think Comment on that one. I think that probably would have been pretty kick-ass. But I mean,
the Terry Gilliam idea too.
Terry Gilliam, yeah. Those. So actually, you're right. There are some good ones in there. But even Paul Greengrass, I cannot imagine this film being filmed in shaky cam the whole time.
Yeah, that and like imagine Terry Gilliam making this movie in the late '80s. You know, Dr. Manhattan would be a guy walking around in blue paint. You know, he would be the Incredible Hulk from the TV series.
Yeah.
It wouldn't work.
I don't even think it's fair to say what Terry Gilliam would have done because he decided it couldn't be done. He said the only way to do it was to make a miniseries, which I actually, to be honest, kind of agree with.
Good point.
David Hayter, the screenwriter.
Go ahead. Go, I'm sorry.
David Hayter, the screenwriter, was pitching it as a miniseries, you know, 10 or 9 years ago. And I actually think it would have been better as a miniseries because it would have given you – you know, if you did it as like 12 different episodes, you know, hour episodes, it would give you time to think and breathe in between, you know, each episode. And I think that's one of the problems with Watchmen is it's so much condensed information and characters. And, you know, it's so just there and it's very deep and you know what I mean?
Yeah. And also, I think, you know, if it had been separated out, like tonally, it would have been a lot easier to take to, like, you know, one chapter would have been devoted to Dr. Manhattan's origin story. And then you have like another chapter devoted to like just the therapy scenes like in the book. Because
in terms of genre, like how it spans different ones, like, for instance, there was an entire section with Rorschach, which was like straight up horror. And then like you cut to that and you have like this comedic almost like sex scene. Actually, I think that was beforehand. Yep. But it just it's kind of jarring, I think, for a lot of audiences.
Yep.
Yeah.
But that being, I'm sorry, Kevin, we interrupted you. Were you going to say something or?
No, not at all. I was going to say that. Well, you know what? I was going to say something. I was going to say, Adam, I don't have a visual reference for everybody, but in my mind, Adam looks like Anthony Rapp from Rent. Am I close?
Actually,
I just see Adam with a scarf around his neck, and you know he's. He's full of integrity. Like, I love Adam was the one to point out, like, hey, man, what was his name? Hold on. The director. Terry.
Yeah.
Terry Gilliam. Adam the one that quickly pointed out, like, Terry Gilliam didn't have a vision because he said it was undoable. It was just kind of cool. But anyway, I see you as a man full of integrity. I see Chen as a sellout, a corporate lackey. No, I'm kidding. But anyway, that's what I was going to say before, and you probably shouldn't have.
Somehow I don't think you're kidding, but that's okay. It's an honor even to be called a corporate lackey by you, Kevin.
No, David, I'm kidding. I like it. I think David's a good guy.
All right, so I want to talk about some of the changes that Zack Snyder made, and so this is going to be minor spoilers. Let's not talk about the ending yet.
Right.
We'll save that for later. But some minor spoilers here. Something that I think is pretty different in the movie is the violence from the book. And I actually found the violence in the movie kind of off-putting, and I have a feeling you guys will have a different opinion here. But, for example, Kevin, that scene you described where they saw off that guy's arms. First of all, I just want to point out, you only need to saw off one of his arms. So that's just, I'm just throwing that out there. If you were in that situation, you could saw off one arm and then extract him from the bar. So that the two arms.
However, but you have to admit, in a high pressure situation, it's faster to cut off both arms.
I don't know if that's true.
But
I think it is. Oh, absolutely. It's way more fast. It's way faster to cut off both arms because you cut one arm, then you've got to guide the other arm with the cuff through the bars and shit like that. You cut off both arms, that dude's carcass falls, and you're ready to go.
Okay, fair enough. I'll give you that one. But there's a couple other situations of violence that I think, you know, there's obviously, I think three things come to mind, okay? Number one, the big scene with Silk Spectre 2 and Night Owl in the alley. So that's number one. Number two is the Rorschach origin scene.
Yeah,
where he.
That's right. That was different too.
Yeah, which
let's go back to the alleyway.
Okay,
scene.
Let's start with the alleyway scene, and the third one was going to be Dr. Manhattan and how he kills people, but we'll get to that later. So yeah, the alley scene. I mean, what did you guys think of that? In the comic book, the violence is somewhat muted, and I understand it's meant to be shocking in the movie, but you know, when you see the bone go through the arm, it seems a little bit like Zack Snyder being Zack Snyder and not Zack Snyder making Watchmen.
No. Okay. The graphic novel, when that came out, the entire point was that this violence was almost like unseen with superheroes. That was the entire point. It was supposed to be shocking. But that was like then. Now you get here, we're used to that. So Zack Snyder had to amp it up in order to make it sort of able to shock audiences currently.
Right.
So I think that was the reason why he did it.
See, I defy – nobody hears – in their head when Adam's talking, no day but today.
So I'm guessing I agree
with Adam 100% okay. on what you said, though.
Okay, all right, fine. Let's move on to number two.
But wait, let's talk about that real quick, though.
Yeah.
What I kind of dug about that sequence, aside from, like, you know, look, the sound mix rocked, the effect kind of rocked of watching, you know, them fight. But I thought it communicated a kind of powerful message that, like, the comics rarely do and probably don't, maybe because A, it's in poor taste, B, because it's redundant, or C, nobody really want to talks about the nature of going out there and being a vigilante. But what that scene imparted to me in terms of, like, dialing up the violence as it did and deviating somewhat from the text, and as much as in the text it's kind of not nearly as graphic, but I thought what it did was, like, established a world where if you did put on a costume, you wouldn't get fucking pointed at and laughed at because you have left a trail of violence in your wake where people are seriously hurt. Like, you know, you think twice about taking on the mask or kind of committing a crime when you know somebody who's like, this motherfucker literally broke their arm in two and the bone came out and now this guy can't ever use his arm again. And that was his jerk-off arm. Like, a story like that would make you think twice about committing a crime. And that's why I thought, like, in that sequence within the movie, it kind of worked, because I was like, man, that if word got out that they were that violent, like, you know, you watch Batman in Dark Knight, and he throws dudes around and whatnot, but you rarely see the effect of what happens when they move to the next scene. Like, you don't see the guy sitting there going, like, I can't believe it, he shattered my jaw or something like that. this sequence was very clear that it's like, these people don't fuck around. And also, it showed how skilled and lethal they were, which was kind of the point of the original scene, too, in juxtaposition to what was being internalized over the scene. So I don't know. That scene worked for me. I thought, like, yes, that is definitely now what's become a Zack Snyder trademark, but I also thought that it was effectively balanced within the scene for me.
That's well said. That's well said, Kevin, and I think I got to agree with you there. So basically,
you know what, though? I do want to say that it would be much easier for Zack Snyder to have filmed that scene like it was in the book, with more muted. And I think him, you know, adding his own touch to it, that's one of the scenes I loved.
Yeah.
All right, so basically, I take back what I said. Please don't write in with angry emails. So what about the Rorschach origin scene? I thought that scene in the comic was quite beautiful, the way he stands outside the apartment and watches it burn to the ground. And I was kind of disappointed that they switched it for a meat cleaver in the film.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you guys thought of that.
It's sort of like the same thing, you know? It's like seeing a supposed superhero walk out of a burning building and let somebody die, you know? We've seen that actually a lot. We saw that in Batman Begins, sort of, you know?
At the end of that. Very nice, yeah.
So it's like, you know, it's not that unknown in current comic movies. And to me, it felt a lot more personal, also really conveyed the insanity that, you know, Rorschach is just fucking insane.
Yep.
Like
and the way that even after the guy was dead, he continued to sort of have his way with the cleaver.
Okay. That was a change that I thought was actually rather effective. And I'm sure, you know, even Alan Moore, if Alan Moore told me that I'm wrong, then naturally I'm wrong. But I'm sure a Moore acolyte would tell me I'm wrong. I kind of felt like that sequence was just hyper-realized from what was already there in the book. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just think Moore maybe felt like, you know, I'm not going to take it the obvious route and have him actually kill the dude. Mm-hmm. Or maybe he did that originally, and an editor at DC was like, dude, scale it back so he at least just watches it burn down. I don't know. But to me, it made more sense to go the route they did in the movie, especially because in the source material, they make reference to the fact that, like, you know, people have died at Rorschach's hands.
Right. Yep. Yep.
So this was just kind of the literal or the display of that with this sequence. I mean, I remember watching that and being like, wow, that is a jump away from the book. And as much as, like, in the book, as we said, he cuffs the guy to something and gives him the hacksaw. And then he just goes outside and watches it burn. And he's like, nobody came out. And it does take it a different level where you're, like, literally having him take the hatch meat cleaver and put it in the dude's head. But while it is different and it does deviate from the text or the source material, at the same time, it's very in keeping with everything else that's in the source material, in as much as it's implied that Rorschach has taken people's lives before. So that worked for me. And it was just like, boy, you want to fucking really point to the moment that the dude snapped. It would be the moment that he himself took a life, you know, more so than like, you know, it's a very powerful and profound scene in the book where it's like he realizes this dude literally fed a child to the dogs. But, you know, it's even more powerful, I feel like, in the movie when he crosses his own line. He was there, you know, as a person who was supposed to protect the innocent and not take lives, and kind of, you know, he was brutish about it, but at the same time, he governed himself. And that was the moment where he's like, fuck it, man. I'm going to do whatever it takes to keep the law.
It was sort of like a wise move in Snyder's part, too, because in the book, we get to spend a lot more time with Rorschach and, you know, and his psychiatrist and, you know, just his origins and his fucked up, you know, early life. So the movie amps this up, but also conveys the same message that this guy is seriously, seriously insane. You know, it's as if the Joker from, you know, The Dark Knight was actually one of your protagonists.
Yeah, like the good guy.
Yeah.
Well, at this point, there's probably a bunch of Kevin Smith and Watchmen fanboys ready to kill me. But I want to bring up one last point, which is the Dr. Manhattan violence. And I'm wondering, you know, in the book, it's completely bloodless when he vaporizes people. And that makes sense because he can manipulate matter to his will. And the movie, of course, I mean, not only is it extremely bloody, but the film kind of lingers on it and revels in it to a certain degree, especially in that scene in the bar when you see the body parts hanging from the ceiling.
Wait, that wasn't in the graphic novel?
I don't think so. No, I think that
I
was
don't
like,
remember that in the book at all.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm wondering how you guys, I mean, and actually that plays into a very significant part in one of the film's last shots. The last guy that Dr. Manhattan vaporizes. And so
that was a really nice touch.
Well, yeah, so that's the question is, you know, some people would say that scene was heavy-handed in a way that the graphic novel isn't.
No, I mean, they have, in the graphic novel, there's tons of symbolism. Like, for instance, on Mars, you have the smiley face. So, I mean, if you call that heavy-handed, then the graphic novel did it too.
Yeah, if you kept that in.
Do you guys think, I mean, do you think maybe that's one of the reasons like Alan Moore never wanted to see it be made, because it does kind of shine a light on the book in a way where suddenly it goes from being like it is the most, you know, read graphic novel of our time, or the best-selling graphic novel of our time, or, you know, on Time's top 100 novel list of all time, and not just graphic novel, but just books, period?
Yeah.
Do you think maybe like he was just like, if they make a movie out of it, other people are going to start analyzing it that perhaps aren't going to look at it so friendly, and like people are going to start pointing to like chinks in the armor. That's what I'd be thinking about. Yeah. I'd be like, man, like right now the whole world believes this is brilliant, but if somebody kind of takes it to another medium, they might find a way to start taking it apart. That's one of the things I'd be protecting. I think that's kind of why he's trying to protect the legacy of the book. Maybe one of the reasons. It's a theory. What do you guys think?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And I think, you know, I was at Comic-Con 2008 in San Diego, and I was at the Hellboy panel. And something that the artist for Hellboy was saying was how after the movie is made, like that is primarily what that property becomes known for. So when you think of Hellboy, most people think of, you know, Ron Perlman. They don't think of Hellboy the comic. And so same thing with Watchmen. And I think that... you know, your point about sort of fearing a deeper analysis may be true, although I don't know how Alan Moore would take to that. But, you know, there's also the point of the legacy of the book and how the movie kind of takes control of that after it's been released.
But
well, I mean, let's go ahead. Sorry, Peter.
I'm sorry. Am I wrong by thinking that Alan Moore was at least accepting of Hollywood trying to adapt his earlier works, and when that went wrong, then he came into that mindset?
Yeah, Alan Moore actually originally was excited at one point for a Watchmen film, because I think that was actually one of the earliest films adaptations that they were talking about with his work. And then basically it kept going through development hell, and then Fox totally screwed up League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and then he had like this whole lawsuit he had to deal with. And after that, I think he's been really against it. Also, because he said that Watchmen was meant to show things that graphic novels could do that literature and films couldn't. So he just didn't really see the point in it. Yeah. I think it's a combination of that mostly. I feel like just Alan Moore is tired of seeing them trying to do his films, his books at all on film.
Yep.
What do you think Alan Moore would say if, you know, he popped the DVD in and watched, you know, The Watchmen, or Watchmen, rather?
I think he would kind of point out the same flaws that everyone else has pointed out. I bet you he would have a real problem with some of the gratuitous violence. Because, you know, like we pointed out, that's not in the book, but it's just like it's on a different canvas. He's going to paint with different colors. Like, touching back on the Dr. Manhattan stuff, you know, it's more, you know, you've in the comic book, you have one panel to convey the fact that he has atomized somebody,
right?
Maybe two at most. In the movie, you know, you've got 24 frames per second, and let's say you even do it for 2 or 3 seconds. You know, you make every one of those frames interesting. It's like having that many panels, like having 24 panels to, you know, show the atom, somebody being atomized. So I don't know. I don't think he could be. Maybe he could be. Maybe Zach could be faulted for being a bit more Grand Guggenheim in the depiction. But as a filmmaker, isn't it his job to make it as interesting looking as possible while still still this dude honored the spirit of the source material? I mean, that's what I'm talking about. It's like this guy was fucked no matter what he did, man.
Yep.
Like, he could never please everybody. And two audiences were gunning for him. Half the people wanted this movie to be awesome. Half the people wanted the movie to suck. And they're never going to change their opinions. You know, a bunch of people didn't want the movie to be made. And now that it is made, and you look at it and you're like, wow, man, you know, even objectively, even if you don't like that movie, you have to like look at it and be like, shit, that's so damn close. That's the closest anyone would ever have come. And this never could have happened 10 years ago or 5 years ago or 3 years ago. Well, I guess it all started happening 3 years ago, but let's say 10 or 15 years ago. Like, this dude actually did it. He brought it to life and saved us from having to watch somebody else's really inferior version. Think about this, people. All those people out there who are like, oh, Zack Snyder ruined The Watchmen with the movie. Thank God Zack Snyder made the movie, because what if I made it? What if they gave me to watch? I'm telling you right now, it would have been a really inferior piece of shit. So be glad that you got Zack Snyder's, because it could have been me. I could have gotten to a place where I'm like, I want to do a $350,000 version of The Watchmen. They're like, go for it. So let's all applaud Zack Snyder.
Yeah.
Yes, totally. And you know what? They're not going to talk about the same shit they used to. I'm going to do a rewrite, you know? And somebody, by the end of it, by the credits, somebody's going to fuck a donkey, I assure you, or get their face shit on. I don't know. It's just so weird. I mean, I get that, like, everything is able, you know, you can look at anything and scrutinize it and criticize it and say good or bad. But it's like, I don't know. You look at the artist's or the author's original intent, and in this case, the author of the movie. The dude said, I want to make the truest version of a Watchmen movie I can. And did he do it? Fuck yeah. Knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
End of story.
I completely. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Adam.
I was going to say, yeah, like, everyone's going to have their own individual, like, ideas of how a certain character should look, or how what certain scenes are most important to include. I mean, you can nitpick the hell out of it. So I totally agree with Kevin here. I think we should just fucking be grateful.
Yeah, yes.
And you know why, too? You know why? Because everybody's experience with The Watchmen, at least in this world, I'm not talking about, like, you know, somebody's parents were like, I heard about this Watchmen movie. I'm going to check it out. I'm talking about people that know the source material and even give a shit about it. I just think all these cats are just like, right on. Somebody did it, man. And this dude did it, and he pulled it off. And I don't know. I it's not like we should all owe him our thanks. If you don't like the movie, fine, I get it. But man, this dude got damn close.
Yeah, and let me just say, for the record, for you, Kevin, and also for everyone listening, I completely agree with you. In my review of the film, I called it a cinematic achievement. I think we have not seen an adaptation done in this way, because it's such a unique book, and I think Zack Snyder really pulled it off quite well. Something I want to ask you about, Kevin, in particular, because you use music and soundtracks in your movies so well, is the soundtrack to Watchmen. Not the score by Tyler Bates, which I think a lot of people think is quite good, but the way Zack Snyder used individual songs to punctuate some of the scenes in the movie. Like, how did you feel about it? Were you like, this is exactly the song that I would choose? Or were you like, this song takes me out of the movie? Because I was kind of half and half. I thought half the songs were really well done and well chosen. For example, Unforgettable during the opening comedian murder scene. And then other songs kind of really were very jarring. And so I'm wondering what you felt about the movie soundtrack.
I mean, if you go example by example, I could probably better comment.
Sure, okay.
Like,
I have a list of the songs right here, actually.
Okay.
So Unforgettable is the...
That was a good choice. I thought that was well used.
Yeah. And then, of course, Bob Dylan's The Times They Are a-Changin' for the opening credits, which
I thought that was great.
I thought one of the best opening credits I've ever seen.
Yeah, no doubt.
Totally.
The Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel for the comedian Funeral.
Maybe a little OTT.
Let's see what else here. Casey and the Sunshine Band.
Wait, is OTT right? Or is it OTN? I thought it was a little on the nose. You probably could have made a different choice, but
yeah.
I thought, it works in terms of evoking period, because that's what the music really did. All of that music evoked period too, as well as played the scene, but kind of like when they dropped, 99. Did you have 99 Luft Balloons in your version?
I was going to mention that as well. Yeah, 99 Balloons.
Okay, like when that happens, suddenly you're like, hey, I know exactly where I am. Suddenly you got a sense of time and place, and I don't know. I thought the selection kind of worked up until that one.
One of the biggest ones, obviously, is Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah that plays in the sex scene with Silk Spectre.
That's the one that I mean. That one I was just like, really? That's the tune you're going to use? Wasn't that in Shrek? They're fucking and it should be really hot, but at the same time, all I can think about is like, oh man, that's a Shrek song.
I was gonna say, like, in the graphic novel, when I read it, the way I read that scene was kind of like they had just done this really intense thing where they save the people, and I kind of envisioned it like the sex scene in Mr. and Mrs. Smith when Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie have just finished trying to kill each other, and then they have this kind of hot sex scene in the kitchen that's like really visceral and brutal. That's kind of how I thought it would play out, but instead it was kind of played for laughs in the movie.
That's actually not a good example, though, Dave, because in Mr. and Mrs. Smith, the song they used behind that fight scene was also not appropriate.
What are you talking about? It was John Powell's score, I'm pretty sure.
No, it was like an old song. It was like an old jazz song or something.
Okay, well, we can debate about
that
later.
Kind of out of place.
But yeah, okay, fair enough. I think, a lot of people thought it was...
I just felt Night Owl was saying, fucking Hallelujah, I got it up. Because that's what I would be thinking if I was him.
That kind of rang through loud and clear. Wasn't it a different song in the book? Like, because there were lyrics going on at the same time in the book in that scene.
Huh.
Who's got a book in front of him? I can't believe we're having this podcast. Nobody's got a copy to watch.
I have a book right here.
Open up to that page. I'm pretty sure there was a song playing because he presses the button on the in the owl ship and there's playing music while he's standing steering on top of it. Remember that scene in the book?
Yeah. This will take me a while to find.
Yeah. Well, Keith, let's keep talking.
So another couple other. Music choices here. Just want to run through them real quick. Jimi Hendrix, All Along the Watchtower,
worked for me. I liked it.
I really enjoyed that one as well. Going back in the movie, Ride of the Valkyries during the Dr. Manhattan Vietnam scene.
I like that. It was an awesome callback to, seminal film about the Vietnam War.
I think a lot of people would agree. And what did you think of My Chemical Romance's performance of Desolation Row?
I didn't hear that. That wasn't in the version that I can't come.
Yeah,
because that was the ending credits.
Yeah, the ending credits. Yeah, and it kind of, I don't know. Well, Adam, what did you think of that song?
I actually expected it to be worse than it was, but obviously I guess my expectations there kind of tailored what I felt about it. I didn't think it was too terrible, but I still, like, why would you get this band to do it? Why?
And also I felt like kind of like after the movie, you kind of want to like sit there and think a while, but like, it's just like blasting this metal into your ears, and I kind of like, I don't know. It
seemed very out of place. I would have much rather, I know Snyder said that he didn't want to include any modern songs, but I would have much rather him had included the Smashing Pumpkins song from the trailer.
Oh, yeah.
The closing credits, which I think.
Yeah, we all got spoiled by that trailer because that usage of that song was pretty amazing. But he mentioned in San Diego, when he showed the other footage during his panel, that he had kind of used that song ironically to redeem it of its lost superhero movie honor because it was used in Batman and Robin. It was such an obscure joke, but I was like, good for you, man.
And I don't think he understood exactly how well it would work because it was so good in that trailer.
Yeah, he knew how well it worked, believe me, but he was also saying, like, I was glad at the end of the day to be able to give it back its dignity.
Kevin, I have that panel here. It's on page 25 of the chapter in which that rescue takes place. And he's standing on top of the ship, and the music is, "You're my thrill, you do something to me, you send chills right through me. when I look at you because you're my thrill.
So it's you're my thrill.
I assume so, yes.
Yeah.
And was that used in the movie at all during the rescue sequence or anything?
I don't think so.
No, oh, that was like all score.
But that is basically part. Yeah, that was part of the soundtrack. Billie Holiday's "You're My Thrill."
Yeah.
So
was it?
It's on the final CD of the soundtrack. So, but I don't recall. It wasn't used in a major way in the movie, I don't think. So.
Right. I don't know. I wouldn't have chosen the Hallelujah song, but it didn't. Like when I watched it in the movie, I wasn't like, "Oh, brother," and I didn't like. I know that scene. Like, even in the book, there's the visual joke of, like, you know, them fucking, and then all of a sudden cut wide, and you see the fire stream go out into the air. So even in the source material, I always felt that scene was played for a chuckle. Not like, ah, ha, ha, knee slapping, but you're like, oh, that's kind of funny. That's clever.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like any good writing, it makes you think, and it makes you think, fuck, why didn't I think of that? Because it's kind of clever and easy. Yeah. So I felt like the scene... The sequence that Zach built for the movie played off of that very well. Naturally, it was longer than it was on the page, but was very much in the keeping. Like, I didn't feel that in the book they were a little more rough with each other, and, you know, in the movie they were all dopey and shit. I thought it was kind of – it matched the tone that I always read that scene with. So
yeah,
I don't remember
it being aggressive at all in the graphic novel.
Not at all, no. It was very, very much the same thing, because you're talking about a guy who, like – it was only because he was able to strap on the mask and go back to being what he was good at that he was able to get his dick up and fuck. And that's what that scene plays like. It's more, I wouldn't go so far as to say tender, but it's just like that dude gets his mojo back with that rescue, and
right,
he's able to perform with her. But it never played to me as like, we're superhero gods. Let's throw each other around the owl ship and jam it. I want you to wrap it on and fuck me. That's how wild I am. You know, it just always played rather like right on there. He's able to finally do it. He feels good about himself again.
You're right. So,
but the choice of that song, yeah, I would have went a different way myself, but it didn't ruin it for me. I wasn't like, oh, that sucks so bad. I'm like, whatever.
Well, aside from the song, how did you guys actually feel about the sex scene? Because
I thought it was sex.
Some of the people I watched it with, they didn't see the point of it. So right, at that point, it's like, you know, how do you explain that? Yeah.
But then it's a question of like, if you have a problem with that sex sequence, then you have a problem with the source material. Because it was always part and parcel with the source material. They didn't create that. That wasn't like something cheesily thrown in for the movie going audiences. That's true to the source material.
Totally.
So anybody that's like got a beef with it, I mean, you can maybe say like, oh, it was a little too long, he could have trimmed it down, or I didn't like the song, but like, that's he's honoring what was in there, and I thought he did a good job of that too.
I think what people's complaints were directed actually towards the fact that it felt like, I guess, almost pornographic,
right?
That's another thing. The graphic novel obviously was meant to play that you weren't also used to seeing superheroes having sex, and here that was what they were playing up as well. Just like he was anting up the violence, he was anting up the how the sex came across in the film, and I thought that worked really well. So when people are saying that's really uncomfortable, I'm just like, okay, good.
Yeah,
I agree completely. I never thought it was like, oh, this is too much. I thought it was, you know, I thought one of the scenes he realized incredibly well, which I always thought was really striking in the book, is the sequence where, you know, she's laying down and his hands are all over, and then all of a sudden another set of hands and another.
Yeah, that was really well done. That was really well done.
He's off working and she's engaged with multiples of him, and he did that really well, man. That worked just like the book. It was like, wow, that's that, and it made you uncomfortable, but at the same time you were like, that's kind of sexy.
Yeah, it was like in the book I was like, I don't understand how having sex with Dr. Manhattan could be hot. But somehow the movie made it hot. I mean, not that I would want to have sex with Dr. Manhattan. I'm just saying.
I could. I looked at that scene. Even in the book, I was always like, what is she bitching about? Like, the dude is offering her, like, a free pass to have sex with, like, three people who are all him. So, like, later on, he can't be like, why did you fuck those dudes that night? You know, because she'll be like, it was you. And he's like, you're right. It's kind of, it's pretty much, it's very erotically charged, I thought.
Yeah.
You know, I've never been. I've always thought that was like, wow, that's pretty cool. Why is she mad at that?
Yeah, that was part of one of the scenes that I thought was really well done in the movie.
Totally.
I'd like to. I don't know if there's anything.
You know what else was real done? Very well done. I was talking about this with my friend Walter, and maybe nobody else noticed this, but this is one of my favorite parts of that book, because, you know, it's never the big scenes. It's always the little things in between that make something very memorable or stick with you. There's a scene in the book where, you know, Night Owl 2, Dan Dreiberg finally loses his shit with Rorschach, and he like kind of yells at him, where he's like, God damn it, you just always make it so hard or whatever. And then Rorschach has an apology moment with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's just like, you know, I'm sorry, Daniel, I realize I make it difficult. And they shake hands, or he puts his hand on him or something. And then Dan goes, you know, it's cool. Like, he realizes, wow, this is a big step for this dude to actually try to make some kind of human non-work related connection, to acknowledge the fact that, like, you know, there is a humanity or a friendship that we used to share that's affected by the fact that I'm so driven by what I do or whatever. And, but Rorschach is so, unsocialized, he does not know how to react or interact with people at all, that his hand stays there for an uncomfortable amount of time.
Nice. Yeah.
There was one panel, and in the book it's represented as, like, you know, he's saying something in one panel with his hand on Dan. Then there's a panel where they're both just standing there and his hand remains there. And then, you know, the next panel is Dan going, well, okay, and, you know, removing his hand. And I always thought, like, in the comic, I was like, wow, because that moment can be translated so many different ways. Like, that was the way I always chose to translate it. Like, here's a dude who's so insanely awkward, who's, like, not had a normal upbringing, who's been bounced around foster homes, watched his mother, you know, trade sex for money, beaten up by kids, chewed on kids' faces, in and out of you know, this dude is broken and barely human.
Yeah.
So to watch that dude, like, suddenly, fuck, what was I talking about? I got lost because I was looking outside. I saw somebody pull up, and I was like, oh.
You were talking about how Rorschach is insane, and then he shook his hands for too long.
Oh, yes. So, you know, the way I look at that sequence is just like, this is a dude who, like, that awkward moment comes from the fact that this guy has no idea how to, like, interact with other human beings. He's used to being alone. He's lived a solitary life where he's had to fight to survive. So he doesn't have the normal social skills that everyone else has, where if you do have to apologize to somebody, you know, you kind of like make joke of it or kind of get it out of the way, or there's not this awkward tension moment, you know, where it's like, yes, well, that's done now. You can remove your hand. That's the way I've always looked at it. The other way you could look at it, and I don't know what Moore's intent was, but that panel could also be read with some sexual tension as well. Where, like, you know, yeah. Where it's not unheard of to have somebody who's staunchly conservative, as Rorschach is portrayed in the book, also have, you know, this other hidden side. So you could look at that moment as this moment where, like, he leaves his hand on him as a kind of show of, like, a test, if you will, like a tap under the stall kind of thing.
You know, there's some talk about that, because there is a scene or a line in the book that is not in the film, where mm-hmm. Rorschach says about Veidt, like something about how he thinks Veidt is a homosexual, must investigate further.
Yes.
And how Zack Snyder said he, you know, I read this on darkhabits.blogspot.com, I think, is a website of a fan of the Slash Filmcast. But this person interviewed, I think, Zack Snyder, and they were saying how Zack Snyder had wanted that line in the movie, because just when you're beginning to like Rorschach, he says that line, and then you're like, oh, you remember, yeah. Like, it snaps you back, like, oh, he's insane, or oh, he's homophobic, right. Or oh, he's a psychopath.
Not even insane, but oh, like, this dude is staunchly conservative.
Right.
Like, you forget, like, in the book, how he calls, you know, women horrors at one point. Like, this is a dude who reads, what's the magazine, the New Frontiersman, or yep. The newspaper.
Yep.
I mean, you know, he's a regular reader of that, which is painted as a very right-wing kind of propaganda magazine. So, you know, it was always kind of present in the character. But it wouldn't be unheard of to, like, for Moore to do something as subtle as that. Like, you know, a lesser writer makes it more obvious. If I'm doing it, you know, there's a scene where he's like, I'll suck your cock, you know, nung, or something like that. But Moore, it could be that Moore is such a subtle genius that he kind of left that panel, you know, up to the translation of each individual viewer to kind of see what you see in that moment. But that might have been something he intended. I always wonder, did he intend that to play as this moment where he's like, you know, Rorschach, when finally dealt with as a human being, like when Dan finally confronts him and his kind of mask cracks or whatever for that moment where he apologizes, that in that moment where he cracks a little bit, a little more of who's underneath Rorschach comes out, and maybe it's this guy who wants to suck Night Owl's cock. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think I'm out of line. I think that's a pretty decent read of that scene. I mean, you know, I'm obviously playing it a little more humorously by with the suck and the cock thing, but I just thought it could have very well have been like him, you know, kind of touching a dude or touching his friend in that way that, like, for years I've wanted to touch you like that. Maybe that's some issues that I have buried inside me, but that's how a possible read of that scene. I wonder if anybody ever, and I guess I, from your abject silence and horror, I can tell none of you ever read it like that. No, so, man, let's just awkwardly and quietly move on to another subject.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say none of us ever thought of it that way, but I think that's an interesting and...
Am I really the only one? I find that shocking. That was one of the things when I've read that book, and I've read that book so many times. But one of the times I was reading it, I was like, oh, shit, maybe this is kind of like a homoerotic moment.
Well, this kind of reminds me of the discussion where we had with... Is Wally a date rapist?
Yeah. but the short answer to that is yes, because he tries to touch Eve's hand while she was unconscious.
Well, that's the thing. It's just like, you know, is that roofie? Isn't that roofie type behavior? You're like, somebody's unconscious and you're doing things with them that they wouldn't have let you do when they were awake. Like, we all know that Eve didn't want to hold hands with him. So the fact that he goes and holds her hand when she's unconscious is kind of creepy, no?
Adam, what have you done?
Holding hands was considered kind of like the whole sex thing in Disney terms. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on. You're talking about subtlety, Kevin Smith, and I want to talk about the ending of this film. So I'm wondering let's just say from now on, spoilers for Watchmen, but you know, most of you already probably know the ending. There's two things about the ending I sort of want to bring up. Number one is obviously the big change that, you know, that it's not the squid that does all the damage. That's the big thing. And number two, a lot of people point out very astutely that in the graphic novel, this is the one part where Zack Snyder made things less bloody and less gory in the movie than in the graphic novel. In the graphic novel, you see, you know, the piles of dead bodies all beaten and battered and bloody and disgusting, and the corpses and sort of the damage that has been done by this this cataclysmic
event. Well, hold on one second.
Yep.
We've all read Watchmen, right?
Yes.
I'm going to elect Adam, because Adam sounds like the smartest of all of us. Adam, you tell us right now, in as many words as it takes, what happened with the squid monster in Watchmen, the book?
You just explain what happened in the book to the audience?
Oh, yeah, like... Yes. Well, to me, too. Like, what? How did all those people die? Why was there blood?
Ozymandias created a genetically engineered, basically supposed to be an alien, and transported it into New York, and it basically just annihilated everything. It basically appeared dead, but I guess it got smashed with the other people.
Can I? I know Adam is talking here.
All right, but everybody knows that's incorrect, right? I mean, not to put Adam on the spot and be like, Adam, you're the asshole of the day. Congratulations, you fucking dickhole.
I'm gonna go hide in the darkness.
That's not what happened. Does somebody else want to take a stab at what happens in the book? And if you have the book in front of you, you can't do it.
Okay, well, that takes me out of contention.
I'll tell you what happens.
Okay.
They build this monster. They teleport it into New York.
Yeah.
Upon teleportation, the monster dies. The monster, you know, is made up of a whole bunch of psychic energy that one of the people on the island, one of the creators of the monster, was a psychic or had psychic abilities. So when it died, the shock, the reverberation of its psychic death, it's the power, the psychic explosion, killed all these people in that, 1 mile, 3 mile, 2 mile radius or something like that?
Yep.
Now, I don't even know if I'm right, but that's what... I always read it as, but everybody reads it as something different. Like, I've had somebody tell me, and then that giant squid ate everybody, motherfucker. And I was like, that didn't happen at all. Nobody knows how the book really ends, except Alan Moore and some smart people who apparently aren't on this podcast. But it's always been a very tough, inscrutable ending. Like, I consider myself a fairly intelligent human being, and I've read Watchmen many times. I still am never quite sure when I get to that last issue, like, what happened? How did all these people die again? Like, I don't quite understand how it happened.
I think that's part of the confusion. It's just like, you know, we knew the squid appeared and people died, but like that disconnect between what happened.
Yeah, but they're like, how did those people
die? Well, my understanding of it, which you apparently is wrong, but my understanding of it is that teleporting matter so that it occupies the same space as other matter creates a gigantic explosion that kills everything in its path. That was my interpretation.
What, all these years, that's what you felt? Or did you just read that off a fucking piece of paper in front of you? Because, dude, that sounded too rehearsed to come off the top of your head.
No, that's, I mean, that is how I interpreted it the first time I read it.
I don't know. I see. I don't even think that's it, dude. Now you got the book in front of you.
I'm not reading the book. My hands, holding up my hands.
Who's got the book?
All right, I can pick up the book from the floor, if you want.
Go to the book and go to the sequence in the book where it describes what exactly happened.
Okay, I will do that. But
which, number one, it's tough to find because it's not real clear.
Yep.
And number two, you know, hurry up because people are listening. But
thanks, Kevin.
Well, how, you know, despite the specifics, how did this new ending work for you guys? Because I think I may have a few problems with it, just the way it was executed.
I actually agree with that. And my problem isn't even really with the changing of the squid, because I think that, I guess, allows unfamiliar audiences to focus more on the message instead of just there being some like huge alien squid creature. And I also think it kind of allows the movie to feel more self-contained in the realm of the characters and how it plays back to Dr. Manhattan.
Yeah.
But I felt like, and this is also, I guess, back to an issue with pacing, there just wasn't enough buildup.
Yeah.
I didn't really feel that shock that I had with the book when this is kind of a spoiler, but Adrian basically says, we are in spoiler territory.
We're in spoilers, yeah.
Okay, so Adrian says the words, I already did it 35 minutes ago. I remember reading that in the book and just being like, holy shit. And in the movie, I could kind of imagine the rest of the audience, and I kind of feel like they were, because there wasn't really any shock with it. It's kind of like, wait, what did he do 35 minutes ago? Wait, what are these characters trying to stop again?
Yeah,
I just feel like it didn't have the same impact.
It was like for me at least, like as soon as Rorschach and Night Owl hit Antarctica, like all the momentum in the movie sort of died down, because that was the point where, you know, you get to Ozymandias's evil lair and he explains the plan and everything. But it's like by the time we see the explosion in New York, you know, we never spent time with the newspaper stand guy and his little friend or the psychiatrist dude. Like, so we see these people die, but it just it sort of felt kind of distant to me.
Yeah, there's sort of
Rorschach and Night Owl were watching it like over TV. It was just like, oh fuck, you know, New York just blew up. Now what do we do?
Well, that is an issue that will be fixed with the director's cut,
because
all those scenes are included.
Yeah, I have the section, by the way.
Well, for you guys, like, were you bothered by the scene where he basically explains his whole evil plan? Like, I know that's in the comic.
Yeah.
But for some reason, it seemed really, really cheesy up on film.
Yeah, but it's supposed to. In the book, he even says it. He's like, you know, what am I, a Republic serial villain? I did it 35 minutes ago or whatever it was. Like, it is kind of, especially more playing with the conventions that he was at the time that he wrote it, he's mocking that whole portion of the genre where, you know, the villain monologues, as Brad put
to it. He actually said that in the movie.
They changed it in the movie too. What am I, a comic book villain?
Yeah,
which is not nearly as powerful a line.
I mean, throughout this entire discussion, we've been looking at this movie like, you know, from the frame of like Watchmen fans, or at least people who know the book, except, you know, none of us remembered the ending specifically. But you know what? This movie is a wide release movie. I saw this movie in an audience filled with people who've never heard of the Watchmen before, and all they saw were the trailers. And I can't help but think how certain things just didn't work well enough for them. And, you know, it works well for me as a fan, and I love the movie for it, but it's just, it's, for me, the ending is the weakest part for a non-fan. You just don't have that connection with the characters in New York. And it just, you know, I don't know. Everyone I talk to, that seemed to be their biggest complaint. Like, they just,
really?
They
I kind of imagine, actually, the entire film being sort of an issue for non-fans.
Oh, well, there's
personally.
That, too.
Yeah,
I mean,
I think that's the smallest issue for a non-fan. It's like, aren't there some people in New York I should be sympathizing with?
Yeah.
For me, I thought that the choice that they made to go with an ending that tied more into Dr. Manhattan for the movie makes absolute sense, and I liked it. I thought it was a great change. And, it certainly helped in the issue of nobody had to explain what exactly the giant squid did. So it totally works for the flick.
What was the point of Bubastis then?
That was kind of the... I did kind of miss that sequence too, where he was, spending more time with Bubastis and describing what Bubastis was. I would imagine if you went into that audience clean, you'd be like, "What's that?"
Exactly. Yeah. It was totally fan service. All around me,
people were saying, "What the fuck is that?"
But you know what? If there was no Bubastis, we'd all be sitting here going, "And how could he, in an age of CG, not include Bubastis?" You know. Yeah. Illustrating the point that this dude was fucked no matter which step he took.
Yeah, it's a really weird balance that he had to strike. But, I had also recently just seen Synecdoche, New York. And for some strange reason, I see a real parallel between these two movies, because both of these are just really tough movies. You have to watch them actively. You can't just sit back and enjoy them. You have to work at it. And I love both movies for it. But at the same time, I wouldn't recommend Synecdoche to, Joe Schmo moviegoer.
Yep.
And at the same time, I don't think we can recommend Watchmen to everyone. Yep. And is that a good or bad thing?
For me, it's good.
I think you have to see the movie, both of those movies, at least twice to fully appreciate them.
I would agree with that, yeah.
I don't know. If I was John Q. Average moviegoer and I was not a comic book fan and I just but I was a movie buff and I didn't post about it on the internet, but I just like to go to the movies a lot. Mm-hmm. Kind of like when my father was growing up.
Yeah.
And I went to see this movie. I may be confused, but I would be like, wow, this movie must be way smarter than me. And obviously, I feel like I've seen something great, so I should kind of maybe give it a second watch or something like that. I don't know. I would be kind of fascinated by this flick if I was not familiar with the source material at all, even.
Yeah. I wish more people thought like that, because to me, it seems like when you give people a difficult movie to watch, they're just afraid, and then word of mouth kills the movie the next weekend or something.
Anybody who is a big supporter of this film, and I'm definitely one. I've loved it since I saw it, but granted, as I said earlier, I have not seen the final theatrical cut, but I saw two earlier versions, which apparently were pretty darn close. So that all being said, anybody who's kind of a supporter of this flick, naturally, you want to go tell the world about it and oh my God, they did it, and please watch it. But will it replace me putting a copy of The Watchmen in the hands of people who I really want to get in touch with the material? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I wouldn't, if I have a choice between a DVD in my hand or a graphic novel to hand somebody who's unfamiliar with The Watchmen, of course I'm going to go with the graphic novel first. It's the richest version of the text. And then I'd hand them the DVD and be like, after they were done with that, and say hey man, you won't believe how close this dude got to the source material. It's frightening how much he did. He did it. I don't know, I sound like a broken record, but in this business, you build up, it's all about juice, right? And you build up enough juice. I said juice, not Jews. But just to be clear, I don't want to be getting a letter like he was on there talking about how the Jews run Hollywood again. No, it's all about juice. And juice is built up based on how much box office you bring them. I've never had any juice based on that. Just enough juice to make the little movies I have. But this dude had juice galore. He could have done anything in the world after 300. And the fact that he chose this and did the version he did, I don't know, man. I'll always have a special place in my heart for that guy. I remember seeing the trailer for the first time going, God damn it, he did it. So, can we nitpick? Are there a bunch of things that... oh shit, this could have been this, or maybe I didn't like this song, or oh my God, it's changed. Yes, but oh my God, it's like that scene in JFK where Kevin Costner is talking to Sissy Spacek and he's reading the Warren report, and he's just the Warren Commission report, and he goes they brought up all these inconsistencies, and he's going, that's like saying, I beat the dog 5 games out of 8 in checkers tonight. And he's stupid because of that. It's just I can't believe that people would sit there and be like, oh man, he fucked this up, he fucked that up, where it's just like, wow, that's the closest anyone ever could have come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of Zack Snyder's juice, do you guys think that...
Did you just say speaking of Zack Snyder's juice?
Yes.
Were you even listening?
I'm actually going somewhere with this, Dave. You ruined it. Thanks
a lot.
Go
ahead.
But speaking of his juice, do you think he's pretty much lost it after this movie? Because
Hell no. I don't think so at all.
Doing that well, though. Like, I mean, the box office tracking people, which I don't know much about, but there people are sort of like calling this movie not a complete failure, but it's not going to make its budget back later.
I think ultimately when everything's said and done, they make it all back and maybe eke out a little profit. But at the end of the day, I don't know. Sometimes a studio loses money making something they really believe in.
Yep.
You know, and like, I'm glad they chose this rather than like, you know, we spent a bunch of money on Australia and nobody went to see it. And I'm like, well, I didn't get anything out of that either. You know, at least in this negotiation, they spent a bunch of money making something and I got to enjoy it because I've been a big fan of the stuff it was based on. So I don't think his juice is ruined. I think basically it's win-win across the boards for everybody. Everybody looks at Snyder is like, wow, man, he did it. He pointed like Babe Ruth and he got it there. Everybody goes, okay, there's a limit to how much we can do with a superhero character out there in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, everyone's to be applauded for a $55 million opening for a dark R-rated movie that ran at almost 3 fucking hours and didn't have any characters that anybody ever saw before. I mean, come on, dude. Any way you cut it, it's a triumph. It really is. And you look at it's win for the studio. I mean, maybe, you know, the shareholders are like, why'd you make this movie? But ultimately, it's win for the studio because, like I said, it attracts talent, you know, and I'm sure some people out there, if it attracts people like you, Smith, then they're out of fucking luck. But not just me. Other cats might, you know, see that and be like, wow, they made The Watchmen, man. I'm going to go to Warner Bros. With my project because those cats are willing to take risks and shit like that. And that's how great movies get made. And so, like, right now, because of The Watchmen, maybe 5 years from now, somebody makes the best film ever made. You know, it's just like you got to think about it long range. Everyone in this world of online journalism about movies, they're so short term. It's all about this minute, this week, this day.
Yeah.
You got to be able to look at it like 10 years in either direction and see what it does then, you know. And I think this movie's win across the boards, even if it just breaks even shit, even if they wind up losing a couple $1 million, because that's it. You know, they're not going to – you're not talking about a vast difference of like this is going to cost them like $50, $60 million. At the end of the day, I guarantee you when all said and done with every source of revenue coming in, if they lost anything, it would probably be under $10 million at this point. They're going to get that.
I don't even
close
think that's going to happen. I mean, even if
I think
the movie
they're going to eke out a profit.
Second, yeah, even if the movie plummets like second week, I mean, there are going to be enough fans willing to buy. How many DVD releases are they having? Like half a dozen. They're going to make so much bank on the DVDs for this film that it's going to be insane.
Yep.
And to sit around and be and carp that like, well, it's not going to do Dark Knight or it's not going to do Killer Business or it may not make a huge profit or big deal. It's going to make its money back. That's like being TP in Jerry Maguire. You know, the little brother of Cuba Gooding who sits there and he's like, he's not big enough for the NFL. You know, it's just like it's pointing out little shit that's like, are you kidding me? Like, are you that negative a son of a bitch that you got to focus on something that like doesn't even ultimately matter? Like, oh, my God, we got a Watchmen movie. We should all be happy. And it's good. We should all be happy about that. And nobody else will ever try this again. And we should all be happy about that. And ultimately, you prove, too, that like, hey, we can take these characters and put them into an R-rated medium and people will still show up to see them.
Yeah.
You know, so next time, maybe we lower the budget and do the same thing. So maybe we get some DC movies that are a little more adult-oriented in nature. Maybe we get, you know, a Swamp Thing that's closer to the Alan Moore vision or something like that. So I don't know. It's all, for me, the way I look at it, I feel like it's win-win across the boards.
Totally.
Nobody's hurt by this movie. And the guy who's walking away going like, this is the best thing that ever happened to me in my life is Jackie Earle Haley, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that dude's Kevin. Back in a big fucking way. And it's almost like, man, this dude was born to play that role. Yes, I heard my name. Sorry.
Tell me this. Like, now that the greatest, you know, graphic novel of all time has been made, what is now the graphic novel that, you know, fans are going to be pining for?
Come on. You know the answer to this question. I don't even have to say it, dude. It's Dark Knight Returns. That's next. That's the one now that everyone will concentrate on for 10, 15 years until it's made. And then everyone goes, oh, they fucked it up, you know? But that's the one. That's the next one. And once they make Dark Knight Returns, I don't know what replaces that. I mean, can you imagine there are a bunch of people going to be like, oh, man, Marvel's got to do.
You don't think Sandman or...
Sandman, I don't know. I mean, honestly, I don't there are people out there that say, yeah, they'd like to see a Sandman movie, but you never heard as many of them as you heard about people talking about The Watchmen or Dark Knight Returns. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot I think a lot of people don't want to see a Sandman movie because they're afraid that story can't be told in 2 hours. Not any one chapter of that story. You know, that's almost like, man, wouldn't it be awesome if HBO did a Sandman mini, you know, series and just did it hour by hour or something like that? Preacher, I think that could be broken down into features. I think you could do, like, you know, have Gone to Texas as one feature, do the first chapter, and then if it takes off, you keep doing them. You know, that also made sense as doing. I mean, look, a lot of us who love comic books and love, like, the more grown up comic books have always looked to HBO and be like, please pick this up and make it, because if you guys did it, it would be great. And Preacher's one of those projects. Everyone's always felt like, man, that should be at HBO, because then they can do it week by week and it could run for like 5 years or something like that. And we don't have to worry about seeing it in one movie. And what if the box office for the sequel falls off? We'll never see The Saint of Killers and shit like that, you know? So I don't know. I just can't imagine after Dark Knight Returns that there's going to be many people clamoring for some adaptation or cinematic adaptation of a grand masterwork. Because I can't. Can you think of? I mean, and this is so not to dismiss, you know, the billions of wonderful comic books and comic stories out there. But, you know, when you talk about the two big guns, the ones that even my mother has heard of, it's Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah. I mean, there's some recent stuff. And I think Brian K. Vaughan has been doing some fucking incredible work, like with Why the Last Man, Runaways, mm-hmm. and Deus Ex. Like, Why the Last Man is something that could easily be translated to film. And I think I don't know if is that project still going on with DJ Caruso?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah, like we haven't heard.
I think so.
Yeah. Hold on. DJ. Wait, DJ's coming in from the bathroom. DJ, are you still working on? Because we all hang out together.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean that series is so cinematic and like it would work well because it's basically written like a really smart action movie at times.
Right.
So I mean we have a lot of good new stuff coming out and hopefully this movie will do well.
Think about it now you have creators who are actually creating material knowing that there's another medium waiting for their material. Like when Alan Moore wrote The Watchmen and Dave Gibbons drew The Watchmen, never in a million years did those dudes ever think there'd be a Watchmen movie.
Yeah,
it's just like who could pull it off? You know, it was the unfilmable work. So I think now you have a generation of writers who are writing not only for the book, but for the screen as well, writing for the page and for the screen. So, yeah you're going to find a lot of adaptation-friendly pieces out there, like Why the Last Man. But I don't think there'd be, and, you know, this is not to degrade Why the Last Man anyway, but I don't think there'll ever be nearly as much of a clamor to see a cinematic adaptation as there was for The Watchmen, as there still is for Dark Knight Returns. Those two are the juggernauts. And I can't think that Marvel doesn't have a juggernaut that I'm aware of. You know what I'm saying? Like, Marvel has a great stable of characters and plenty of stories to draw from, but they don't have one of their big graphic novels. You know, I think of stuff that I love, like I would love to see Fearful Symmetry, the Spider-Man Kraven storyline, but they're never going to make that as a movie. But I can't think of, can you guys think of any like Marvel graphic novel or big story that like screams out for adaptation?
Well, you know what it is? Yeah. I think there's not enough time. Like, Why the Last Man, I think, could be to that level of Watchmen if you gave it 15 years, but it's going to be made, you know, much sooner than that.
Right.
And I think part of the reason why, you know, Watchmen, you know, to be a classic can only be a classic, you know, if you give it enough time to be considered a classic. It can't be a classic, you know, tomorrow.
Right.
I think.
Yeah. And to go back to Marvel, I mean, they fucked up the Phoenix story, and that was something good that they had. And you've also got Age of Apocalypse, which you can't do anymore, given the way they set up the movies.
And so, I would also argue that Age of Apocalypse is probably not a seminal key storyline in Marvel history. Like, I don't want to get into like throwdown geek style.
Nah,
but like,
I really don't care.
When I think of the big Marvel storylines, like that one doesn't even enter the top 100 probably. Yeah. But like, they blew Silver Surfer and Galactus already, so they can't do that. And that was kind of a huge Marvel tentpole.
They're really short sighted in what they're doing.
Yeah. To be fair, that's not Marvel's fault, though. You know, a lot of those movies that we mentioned weren't even made by Marvel Studios. Now, once they kind of took over the manufacturing of their own product and opened their own studio, you can see that they obviously care about the integrity of each character and storyline. So, I don't know. That's kind of cool. But you can't fault them for, like, the Galactus cloud, you know?
Yeah.
I'd like, if I can, to redirect us slightly back to Watchmen. Kevin, you were saying how... the Jackie Earl Haley is going to benefit greatly from this. I actually also just want to give a shout out to Jeffrey Dean Morgan, who played the comedian. Right from the first shot when he's smoking his cigar and making his tea or whatever, to, you know, every single scene he's in the first third of the film, I thought was just perfect embodiment of the comedian.
I mean, cast wise, I thought everybody did a really good job. I thought Malin Ackerman was completely effective in what she needed to be and cute. When she wasn't effective, just cute to look at. But, you know, it's not like that character is the deepest and richest in the Watchmen story anyway. You know, we're always drawn to the big guns. We're always drawn to Rorschach. We're always drawn to Dr. Manhattan. So I'm not saying, hey, that's a thankless role. But, like, I thought she did it well. I thought she acquitted herself admirably. Same with Patrick Wilson. You know, I've seen him be better, but I thought he did a really good job as the Night Owl. But, I mean... Jackie Earl Haley.
Yep.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Let's just call him, what was the name of the Bad News Bears? Kelly Leak. Let's just call him Kelly Leak. Kelly Leak knocked this one out of the fucking park, man. Big time. And he's going to get to fuck Tatum O'Neill because of it, if we're going to speak in Bad News Bears parlance. He was the one who always had the showiest part. And also, he's got a great backstory, which everyone wants to embrace. Like, hey, man, that's Kelly Leak. He hasn't worked in a long time. And he came back with little children. And here he is dropping science in the Watchmen of all movies. So, you know, I think he benefits greatly. I think it puts him on everybody's radar. He's definitely the most memorable character in the movie for people who just see it casually for the first time, let alone people who've loved the book for a long time. Crudup, I thought, did a great job. Jeffrey Dean Morgan, as mentioned, did a good job, great job. I thought he was wonderful. And considering, like, you know, they had to age him up a lot, I thought it worked. I thought he was convincing. I thought the age makeup looked well. I thought Nixon, they always had a hard time with. Nixon definitely looked like he had a lot of makeup going.
That came across as really weak in the film, I felt.
Definitely.
Just makeup-wise, it definitely felt like, you know what, maybe you guys could get away with going with a Anthony Hopkins version of Nixon, in as much as he doesn't necessarily have to look like him.
Right.
As much as, like, hey, somebody call him Nixon and we're halfway home.
Right. Crudup, I thought in particular, I mean, when the first trailers came out, it was kind of weird to see a normal human voice come out of Dr. Manhattan. But in the film, the way Crudup plays him as sort of this detached and delivers his monologues in a very monotone style, I just thought was perfect.
Yeah, I really dug that. I mean, when I saw, like I said earlier, I saw a version where, you know, most of the effects weren't even done. So most of the Watchmen that I've seen is Billy Crudup wearing this weird outfit. and still, he was able to, like, I was never taken out of the movie. I was not like, oh, my God, this is ridiculous. Or, man, I wish they had the CG effects done. His performance was so good that even though I was looking at him in that getup, I was just like, wow, that is Dr. Manhattan. That is John Osterman.
Do you guys remember Crudup's performance from the English dub of Princess Mononoke back in the late 90s?
No, is it strong?
It was really good, and I think one of the best dubs ever made. And I felt like his Dr. Manhattan really evoked that, like, sense of calm and just, you know, I don't know, just...
But he's always very good at playing that. Even in, like, Almost Famous, when he's playing a rock star of that group, he is kind of the most centered, the calmest of the bunch.
Mm-hmm.
I like Crudup, man. I'm a fan.
Yeah, I don't think people are actually giving him enough credit in the film. Even the people that are talking about how great he was, like, I don't think they realize, like, imagine how hard that is to – you're playing a character that has to look detached from basically humanity while also be an emotionally compelling character. And Billy Crudup did just such a fantastic job with it that, I mean, I don't think people are really giving him enough recognition.
Definitely.
And you're also like, you have to come to work every day. And in a world where everyone else at the job is wearing a kind of retarded looking costume, yours is the absolute worst. Because it's not even like, let's make it look kind of cool because it's going to be seen on screen. They're just like, you put this shit on. And he's like, man, you know, can I wear something else? This sucks. And also, you know, to keep a straight face while you're wearing the outfit that he had to wear and be there for the other actors, because he just as easily could have been like, you know what, man, not for nothing, but somebody else can stand there and be Dr. Manhattan. I'll check in later on, do the voiceover work. But, yeah. You know, he was there for every frame of the film from what I saw, so good for him.
He's like the next Andy Serkis.
Totally. Did we miss anybody cast-wise?
Matthew Good. We didn't talk about Matthew Good.
That's a big question.
Matthew Good. I liked Matthew Good a lot, and I thought, well, that's kind of the problem, though, with the Ozymandias in the film versus the book, is just as right now he was kind of an afterthought for me, same thing in watching the movie. You know, in the book, Veet, they're able to string Veet in early on, and he's in there a lot more, and you feel the presence, or Veit, as they call him Veit in the movie.
Yeah.
Veit.
I had to correct him. Like, I'd been calling Ozymandias Ozymandias my whole life until I saw the movie. And same thing with, I always thought it was Adrian Veet, and then I saw the movie, and I'm like, oh, it's Veit. But anyway, like, in the book, you feel him even before you get to spend time with him. Because he's there in every issue, but like in the movie, they don't get the same amount of time, and also because some of his history has been truncated, and things have been added. You know, so I felt like maybe Ozymandias, between the book and the movie, that was the biggest change or alteration in the character. I mean, he carried himself the same way, but like in the book, it's a much richer character than he is on the screen.
Yeah.
But that being said, I thought Matthew Good did a really good job with it. I saw him talk at Comic-Con, and he spoke about how he would inflect the character's delivery with a little bit of German whenever he was heightened or excited, because his natural tongue was German when he came to this country. And even though that wasn't the case in the book, this was something that Matthew Good had come up with for himself, from what I understand. But he was just like, I just saw him as having this very German approach to life based on the character sketch. And so I played him that whenever he kind of slipped into, like, when his pulse was quickening or whenever he was getting excited, he would lapse back into a German accent. And so there's one or two moments in the movie where he does that. And it was really, really cool, especially after having heard him talk about it. But I don't know if it reads for anybody who wasn't in the room when he talked about it.
I don't think it works well.
Yeah, because that was the one thing where I was like, what the hell is wrong with his accent? And I found out.
Well, see what I'm saying? Like that description. Yeah, the description he gave, like, really made it work for me, because then I saw the movie after that. Yeah. But if you don't know that, I guess it might just play as like, did he just suddenly start rocking a German accent?
Yeah, it felt really inconsistent. It was like it was unintentional.
If it was a little more consistent, like when he actually did it, maybe it would be less confusing. I don't know.
One of the main complaints about him, actually, the character, is that in the movie, a lot of people were saying it was way too obvious that he was the villain. And I don't know if you guys got that. I mean, it's hard for us to get that vibe.
It's impossible to separate yourself from knowing that he is the villain the whole time, you know?
Yeah.
Fair enough. Well, speaking of Veit, Kevin, I actually have the passage in case you're interested from like 20 minutes ago.
Right, rock on. Let's hear it. Let's hear Alan Moore's description of the squid that kills New York.
Okay, so Night Owl says, Adrian, this is crazy. Who'd believe an alien invasion? And Veit says, Hitler said people swallow lies easily, provided they're big enough. I plan to build my monster, teleport it to a certain destination. And then Rorschach interrupts him and says, you said teleportation was unworkable. And then Veit says, it works fine, assuming you want things to explode on arrival. Teleport it. Okay, but then, so I was right
about
that.
That's not it. That's not it.
Yeah, that's not it. So teleport it to New York. My creature's death would trigger mechanisms within its massive brain, cloned from a human sensitive. The resultant psychic shockwave...
Human sensitive, mind you, is a psychic. Somebody with ESP abilities. Yes. Go ahead.
The resultant psychic shockwave killing half the city.
So what killed those people was a psychic shockwave.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I was totally wrong.
Why was there blood then?
Their brains exploded psychically. I don't know.
And maybe they just kind of leaked out of theirs. Okay, now see how long it took to get to the crust of that? Like, that works on the page because you're like, wow, he's just, well, I hope this is what he's doing. He's just, you know, putting a magnifying glass on how ridiculous comic book villains have always been, or, you know, as he points out, Republic serial villains or something like that. That's how I always took it, you know, that he's just kind of doing that because that's what they would do in a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
Am I wrong?
My take on it is kind of, so you're saying that Like, are you talking about Veidt's locution and the way he explains that in sort of a like a comic way? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. In terms of like having a guy who kind of sits there and tells his heroes what's about to happen. That works on the page, especially when what he's telling them is like, I'm teleporting this giant monster there, and its brain, which has been cloned from like somebody with some extra, normal sensory powers, when it transports there, when its massive brain is affected by the transportation, the resulting psychic shockwave will destroy, everyone in the city. On the page, that kind of works, and it also ties in with the time-honored tradition of like having a comic book villain say something so ridiculous and labyrinth in that you're just like, what the fuck's going on? Kind of like my description of it right now. but I don't know that that would have ever worked in the movie. That would have just like, in a world where you might have had normies, casual people, newbies who just came in, don't know shit about the graphic novel or Alan Moore and just wanted to see this movie. At that point, you would have lost those cats, I think. But as it turns out, some cats didn't get it anyway, regardless of what it was.
Right. Well, yeah. And also just that entire subplot would have required so much exposition beforehand as well. That would have been like an extra half hour on the film.
Or they had to give Matthew Good 2 minutes to sit there and be like, I collected a bunch of artists.
Exactly.
Well, maybe did some animated cutaways or something, but again, it was neat. It was pointless.
Again, nothing I'm saying here should be taken to be a severe criticism of the movie at all, but there is the idea that the book does show lots of people bloody and battered and dead. And the movie kind of saps the book of its, that horror. I don't know if you felt that way.
It's like Snyder goes reverse. Through most of the movie, he's being more violent than the book is, and at the end of the book, or at the end of the movie, he's less violent than the book is.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if that really worked for you, or did you want to see, was there kind of a... For me, I kind of had this impulse to sort of see the horror that Veidt was inflicting on people and not just have them all vaporize in order to really grasp like the significance of his actions.
I was kind of okay with it. I mean, at the end of the day, it's like there was enough blood in the movie where I'm like, I was all right with not seeing more. And yeah. I'm not even one of those people that's squeamish. Like, I wouldn't have cared either way, but I didn't feel like it affected my enjoyment of the movie where I was like, they really fucked up by not showing me some dead bodies in New York because, God damn it, I don't know what dead bodies in New York after a travesty look like. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I think in good taste, perhaps Zach couldn't have shown you shots of dead people falling off buildings and shit in New York based on
kids
the fact
in the
that,
playground.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it in real life. Like, we don't want to see it in a movie where it's
exactly.
Like, wow, even dudes with superpowers couldn't have even stopped this kind of cataclysm. So I don't know. I think that was the wise choice.
I think that was rather
tasteful. Go ahead, Kevin. Finish yourself.
I just thought that was rather tasteful that he didn't show dead New Yorkers,
Devendra and then Peter.
Yeah. I was going to say, I don't know if questioning the bloodiness of the ending is really what should is really the big problem with it. For me, it was the fact that also, he blew up New York. And this is like, this is post 9/11 America. New York has been blown up in our TV and our movies and everything, like pretty much a dozen times a year. Like we live now to blow up New York. It's like a badge of honor. So seeing it again in this movie, it was just sort of, it wasn't as effective to me just because of the fact that we've seen it so much. Yeah. And also,
I'm just saying I can totally back that because in the first draft of Zach and Mary Make a Porno, we blew up New York at the end.
I wouldn't be surprised given the way some things are going these days. But I mean, you guys have seen, some of us have seen the first season of Heroes. And let me just say, Heroes pretty much rips off Watchmen like completely.
They do that in season two, right? At the end of season two, they kind of pull the Watchmen ending, I remember.
Yeah, they hinted at it in season one, but they also explained the reason for doing it to like lead to perpetual peace and everything in season one. And it's just like, really? You're really going to steal an entire plot point from Watchmen?
Yeah, but are you serious? You're not going to call Heroes up on the carpet for stealing plot points. I mean, the beauty of that show, the beauty of that show is that they distilled all the things that we love about every comic book story we've ever read and kind of filter it through. And this maybe didn't get quite as filtered and was a little more liberally borrowed. But like, that's why that show worked for me. I'm like, oh my God, they're doing Days of Future Past. Oh my God, they're doing this, they're doing that. And it's a real best of kind of thing.
But
and
what
oh
I'm
my.
Saying is like, you know, Heroes, you know, the distillation of all this comic book shit blew up New York with a nuclear weapon. And now like Watchmen, you know, it's like coming full circle. Now Watchmen, like, you know, the, you know, preeminent, like, best version of, or, you know, one of the greatest comic book movies ever made, ends up using the same finale. And it's just, to me, that kind of lessens the impact. That's all.
Yeah. Right.
But, yeah.
I mean, I'll say again, I don't think that was really the issue either. I just felt like it wasn't enough build up to that final, like, climax. Like, it just didn't have the impact.
You don't really feel the stakes. The stakes, like what was at stake, and hopefully that is something that will be fixed in the director's cut, like you said, Adam. I think
definitely,
yeah.
But again, as you said, Kevin, these are minor, microscopic nits to pick in something that is just a breathtaking achievement by Zack Snyder. Peter Serrett, are you there? I think you were going to say something earlier.
Yes.
Go ahead. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah. Go ahead. You were going to say something earlier.
Peter's got that effect on his voice right now that sounds like, Prince of Darkness? Remember that movie Prince of Darkness where the dude was like, I've got a message for you and you're not going to like it. That's what Peter sounds like right now, like a creepy dude outside of a church who's about to fall apart.
Yeah, I'm in a hotel room and my internet sucks horribly.
Oh, it's bad internet, dude. It's thin. You're coming out weedy and wispy.
All right. Well, in that case, why don't we wrap this segment of the show up then?
No, wait. Peter didn't get to say his thing.
Oh, that's
yet.
Right. Yeah. So, Peter, you want to go or can you hear us?
Wait, talk about what?
Peter, I'm going to hang up. I'm going to hang up and then I'm going to call you on the phone so that you can say your final words about Watchmen, okay?
You were a wise man, Dave.
Okay. I'm just saying, Peter, sometimes people with money who invest in websites listen to these podcasts, dude.
All right,
you gotta be—you gotta be sharper than that, brother. You know, he's like, "What's going on? Who now? You can't hear me. I'm out of here."
Who in the what now?
Yeah. Yeah, really.
Okay, all right, Peter. So, you want to give us some closing thoughts on Watchmen before we close off this episode?
I love the movie. I think it's a near perfect adaptation. I don't think anybody could have done a better adaptation of that graphic novel. But in effect, I think that it's not an accessible movie for someone that hasn't read the book.
Yeah.
I was with someone, and I'm not saying they wouldn't like it. I was with someone that, you know, halfway through the movie, I looked at her and I was like, "Are you liking this?" And she was like, "Yeah." And I was like, "Do you understand anything?" And she was like, "No, not at all." I think she wants to see it again. I get the impression there'll probably be a lot of people like that. And in the end, obviously, you know, more people are reading Watchmen today because of this movie than probably have over the last, you know, 20 years or whatever. And in effect, I think that makes it all worthwhile anyways.
Yep.
But I do think that there is a value to having a graphic novel in your hand and being able to spend some time between the panels and even read back, like, you know, certain lines and to take your time with it, where in the movie there's lines that go by you, and if you haven't read the graphic novel and don't understand who some of the characters are or what they are, it could be confusing.
That's a fair point, but I think overall it sounds like you're positive on it. Let me just ask Adam Quigley and Devinder Hardware for your closing thoughts, and then I'll give you the last word, Kevin. But Adam Quigley, your closing thoughts on Watchmen.
Okay, well, there's a couple things we didn't really get to talk about. I just want to say it really quick. I actually didn't think Malin Ackerman was that great as Silk Spectre. I think they could have cast someone else and probably would have worked better. I also think that the reveal with her character, with the comedian being her father, also had the same problems as the ending. It didn't have the necessary impact. You didn't really get enough build-up to understand why you should be taken aback by that. But once again, like, these are all issues that kind of come with doing a very literal adaptation of the source material. And I think we probably got the best possible adaptation that anyone could have asked for. And this is actually, I kind of wrote an article about the fact, the limitations of doing a faithful adaptation, alwayswatching.net. So plugged my own site there, check it out. And
He's like, I just want to say that I have a website. Please visit it.
Exactly. Alwayswatching.net. Thumbs up. I love the movie.
Devinder Hardware, closing thoughts on Watchmen.
Yeah, I really dug this movie as well. My only, concerns with it is that it's just so closed off to mainstream audiences. And I think, the script is actually pretty brilliant in how it really structures, it really structures the movie around Rorschach. And, you could really follow it as just like this whodunit, who killed the superhero type movie. But after a point, you can't really follow that plot line. And then it just gets too confusing for most people. But you know what? I love big, clunky, difficult movies to watch. The movies that make you really work at it, like The Fountain and like Synecdoche, New York. And, I don't know if it's snobby, but I love this movie for what it is.
As for my closing thoughts, I wrote a review for this film at slashfilm.com. And in the closing paragraph of my review, I said that there's this great line in the movie where this newsman says, "The Superman exists, and he's American," referring to the creation of Dr. Manhattan, and sort of heralding, this event that is going to change all of us forever. And I don't think I don't know if the existence of a Watchmen movie is of the same magnitude in terms of its eventness, but I did want to say after seeing the movie, the Watchmen movie exists, and it is Zack Snyder's. And that's how I feel about this movie existing. I just think it's a great achievement, a great advancement in terms of how people can adapt something to the big screen, and Zack Snyder should be commended. Kevin Smith, closing thoughts.
Oh, I've sucked this movie's dick enough. You all know I like it very much, and naturally, as a guy who loved The Watchmen, I loved it. As a guy who loves comic book movies, particularly when they're well done and faithful, I loved it. As a guy who looks at it and goes, "I could never do that in a million years," I loved it. And as a guy who actually works in the business of show or in film, I liked it. I just liked it on every level, man. I'm like, we'll be able to nitpick, and I'm sure I'll find things to nitpick at as time goes on and whatnot. And more always in good nature than anything else, because I'm glad we live in a world where this movie exists. I'm happy. Yeah. After all this time that there's a Watchmen movie, and it wasn't dreadful, that it was actually strived to be as close to the source material as possible. And, I'm sorry that Alan Moore doesn't want anything to do with it and didn't want to see it. Hopefully he does eventually give it a watch, and maybe he, doesn't hate it as much as he thought it would. But I'm glad this movie exists, and I'm glad that Zach, stepped up and took his what may be his only pass, his only golden ticket, because maybe he'll never get another one. And he used it. He used his juice to do something that we've all been bitching about for years. We've all wanted to see a Watchmen movie. All right, maybe not everyone. There's some people out there that feel it was unfilmable and it should never be done. But come on, we've always been like, wouldn't it be great if there was a Watchmen movie? Think about reading Wizard in the mid to late 90s. They would always do those casting calls in the magazine. How many times they did a Watchmen movie casting call where you're just like, wow, man, wouldn't that be awesome? Even though they're just going to cast fucking Patrick Stewart as Dr. Manhattan because they're both bald, but whatever. it's like at least somebody's dreaming about it. Somebody's thinking about it. And now we live in a world where it happened. And, I don't know. That makes me feel good. And, I'm sorry that everyone's not going to see it that way, but they're never going to see it that way. It doesn't diminish the book by any stretch of the imagination. If anything, it should make people curious to want to go look at the book for themselves and see what all the hubbub was about to begin with. So, I don't know, man. I mean, shit. All I know is I look at that movie, and I know I could never do it, so I'm glad he did it, and I think he did a great job.
Indeed.
Amen.
Amen. And Kevin Smith, we always close every episode by asking each of the people on the podcast where we can find more of your work on the internet. So if you
I'm gonna donate my spot to Adam because he's got some shit to plug. Go ahead, man. Do that address one more time.
Alwayswatching.net. That's my personal film site. You can also check out my weekly DVD column every Tuesday, slashfilm.com, and follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/alwayswatching.
Okay.
And also, he's in the roadshow production of Rent, which you guys will be able to see. It's coming through your town. He plays the Anthony Rapp part as well. He wears a scarf. It's very good. He's good. He's really good at it. You should not give up. Don't give up the stage, Adam. You're good at it.
Peter Serretta, where can we find more of your work on the internet?
You can find it on slashfilm.com and twitter.com/film.
Devinder Hardware.
Peter, ironically, will also be in the same production as Mimi. So it's you see it. It's a real slash cast production and slash film production slash cast. It's pretty cool.
Are you giving us hints about your next movie, Kevin, or your next?
Yeah, I'm gonna make Rent because it worked out the first time.
Exactly. Devendra Hardware, where can we find your work on the internet this week?
You can find me writing at slashfilm.com and Twitter at twitter.com/Devendra, and you can find everything I do at devendra.org.
And you can find me at twitter.com/Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chen SKY. You can also follow my Tumblr blog at davechen.info. Finally, I just want to point out you can find back episodes of the Slash Filmcast at slashfilmcast.com. Also, feel free to email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. And I know Kevin Smith doesn't want me promoting his stuff, but Zach and Miri Make a Porno is now out on DVD.
Gosh, let's not talk about it. You can find Kevin Smith at the corner of Santa Monica and La Brea, where he's always on the lookout for the most convincing-looking transsexual hooker.
All right, well, Kevin Smith, I think I speak for all of us and the hundreds of people listening live right now. It's been an honor to have you on the show. And
Really, it's my pleasure. It's fun doing it live, man. Smodcast, you know, we always record, but this was I like doing it live, going like, wow, I can't edit that. I said it. I actually said that the Jews run Hollywood. I'm fucked.
Yes, indeed. So you're always welcome back anytime, obviously, and we'd love to have you again, but we really appreciate you donating your time today. And for those of you who are listening to the podcast, stick around. There's more to come. We're going to be talking about film news and also some other movies that we've been watching recently. So stick around. This has been the Slash Filmcast, the official podcast of slashfilm.com. We'll be right back. No reason to get excited. The thing they kind of spoke. There are many here among us who feel that life is but a joke. But the